Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Risonel, and I'm your host on today's program, bringing independent media making outside the U.S. and empowering women to speak with their own voices. My guest today is Anne Elizabeth Moore, and she'll be talking to us about her work in Cambodia and, of course, lots of other great work in independent media. Do stay tuned. And welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been involved in independent media for a while now.
For a while, a long while. Since I was quite young, and at the age of 15, I started making my own, they used to call them fanzines. Maybe you've heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now they just call them zines, or actually some kids call them zines, which is kind of weird, but whatever, kids today. And have done things like work with Punk Planet magazine, work with sort of larger national magazines, but really have devoted myself to print publishing for a long time.
And Punk Planet was based here in Chicago.
Yeah. Punk Planet was around for about 13 years. And I was around right as it was being founded. It was founded by Dan Sinker. And then I went off to Seattle to work in the comic book industry for a couple of years and then came back. And Dan wanted someone to run the magazine while he was out having babies. So came back and we were working together for a little while. And the last 3 years were pretty great until everything went wrong.
Went wrong for a lot of independent publications right around then.
It did. Yeah. There were a lot of things causing that, for sure. I mean, besides the sort of post office rate increase that Time Warner had come up with in order to, in a lot of ways, like bilk independent media out of its cold, hard cash, and ended up proposing a rate hike that, of course, we know didn't cost Time Warner very much, only 10% of a rate hike increase, but cost independent magazines between 30 and 40% mm-hmm. more for bulk mail rates. Yeah, pretty crazy time in terms of corporate interests infiltrating the
mm-hmm.
Government. and of course, that's where Unmarketable came out of, is this general sense.
And that is your book.
Yeah, Unmarketable, Brandalism, Copy Fighting, Marketing, and the Erosion of Integrity. So Unmarketable was about the corporate infiltration of the cultural underground, but also about sort of the demise of Punk Planet and how things like the postal rate increases and the Tylenol marketing campaigns and recent Nike marketing campaigns have really served to deliberately cut out this notion that we as individuals have the right to create our own media.
And Punk Planet, I mean, someone hearing just the name and they not having seen the magazine might associate as merely being a music journal dedicated to punk music, but it was a broader in its scope than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was devoted to independent publishing in sort of a very core way. We were not interested in taking ads from major labels. Of course, it came out of this like mid-90s selling out debates that I actually start writing about, start off Unmarketable with as well. And we were trying to write about these anti-capitalist, non-major media movements that happen just sort of emerging out of the social circles of people that we knew, throughout the world, really, but people who sort of weren't interested in becoming movie stars and weren't interested in only buying Sony records and wanted to just make their own music and put out their own work. And some amazing things have come out of that. Most of them in recent years have sort of moved on to become very great mainstream successes, and to a greater or lesser degree, like they're still doing amazing things and we still respect them. But without that background of sort of absolute freedom of expression that at least I felt for a couple of years when I was a teenager, they wouldn't be the artists that they are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you've had experience here in publishing in a variety of forms, either from very personal to some larger scale, and you continue to work in the print medium. And the reason I sent you an email is because I had an opportunity to see a art show that you had up about a month and a half ago now. Called is it Holly or Hala?
Hala Cambodia.
Hala Cambodia.
It's a made up word, so you can pronounce it however you want.
Okay, Holly.
Holly.
Cambodia. Cambodia. And I thought it was a very, to me, it was very inspiring to go see it, and it's very simple in its outline. But you can describe it for people. You know, it's a project where you went to Cambodia and you helped women who are in a residential college environment make zines.
Yeah, really simple.
Very simple. But I don't think people realize, you know, have a real good sense for the context. The social context of Cambodia, and why in that context this is an amazingly radical thing to have happen. So, I mean, you could say more about, I mean, why you were there and what caused you to undertake the project.
Yeah, it was, I mean, the reasons that I started looking at Cambodia again in the first place, because I'd been fascinated with it when I was a little bit younger, is that the reasons that Punk Planet sort of shut down, what I talk about in Unmarketable, is the sense of accidental censorship, where governments don't necessarily walk in and take all your computers and your Xerox machines and then shut you down. In the United States, we have a free market economy. We have a democracy. They put policies in place that make it more and more difficult for you to do your work. And Cambodia considers itself a democracy. Cambodia is doing its best to instill a free market economy. And yet, there is very little way in the way of freedom of expression, and certainly very, very little of freedom of the press, and tight government control over what is and is not said. And a lot of this has to do with the current government's ties to the Khmer Rouge, which, of course, have still not completed their trials 30 years later. And there's still Khmer Rouge sort of, you know, hopefully about to be tried for war crimes, finally, which is a process that is taking forever. And so there's been no, like, change, you know, despite that the war has ended, the civil war that came out of the Pol Pot years has ended now, finally. But there's been no moment where everyone can sort of galvanize around and say, well, let's move on now. You know, everyone during the Khmer Rouge years was farming rice, and now everyone is farming rice. And so it's a very strange environment anyway. Now, on top of this, of course, there's fear. There's an enormous amount of fear, and there's an enormous amount of fear of expressing your opinions, especially if they're negative of anyone. And journalists are regularly beaten, threatened, maimed, or killed for just doing what we understand the job of a journalist to do. And on top of this, the Khmer Rouge years are not actually taught in school. And so half of the country now, 51% of the country now, is under the age of 21, and most of them don't actually believe that the Khmer Rouge existed.
Wow.
And so one of the students that I met said to me straight, right out of the box, well, didn't you see that movie, The Killing Fields? Because at the end, they showed all the actors. And this was his explanation for how
it was
the
fictional myth
of the Khmer Rouge had been created.
I see.
To entertain American audiences. And to be honest, a lot of that anti-American sentiment, you know, used to exist. It was a part of the Khmer Rouge situation, but it's sort of dissipated now in the desire to move into a free market economy. And so now there's this total embracement of commercialism. That, of course, you know, when I was sort of combining that with this, oh, my gosh, the kids today, they don't believe that the Khmer Rouge existed, I sort of realized, like, and they're never going to be able to develop a way of educating themselves and communicating about these things that they could piece together if they had the options to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was invited to go to Cambodia, and I just thought, well, I'll just see if I can teach them self-publishing. I mean, that's what I do when I go to visit groups of kids. We'll see if it works here, too.
Now, were you invited specifically to do that?
I was more invited to sort of, I was invited to be a resident, mm-hmm. just as a leadership resident. So a strong woman figure who mm-hmm. Behaves. and I kind of developed this program. I mean, I had been teaching zine making workshops in this particular way for a number of years, and just thought maybe there's a way to actually teach this in Southeast Asia to young women who have no natural inclination to self-publish or necessarily any ownership over their own voice, and
mm-hmm.
Thought that it would probably fail.
But it didn't.
No. It still boggles.
And, I mean, was your introduction subtle or, you know, I mean, you have a cultural barrier, and I guess most of these women spoke English to some degree.
I speak English very well.
And mm-hmm. and I'm assuming you don't speak Cambodian.
I tried to learn. Okay. I did learn a little bit. Okay. My name means to read, which made it a little bit easier to explain what we were going to do mm-hmm. together. I learned other words too, but that's the one I remember.
So they took to it.
Yeah, they did. They took to it really fast. They took to it so fast that very quickly they had integrated zines into their school reading materials. Hmm. And so at night, some of them would read, you know, the medical textbooks that they had to read for school, but others would read the history of Phnom Penh that Savri had just finished making the other day. And by the way, had spent 2 weeks translating in her own time after school, first translation into English of the history of Phnom Penh, this textbook that she had mm-hmm. been studying for school. I mean, this is a 17-year-old girl who, you know, isn't even studying English, isn't even, you know, interested in this. She's, I believe, studying nursing. And I mean, they just immediately became engaged in this idea that they could make something of their very own, mm-hmm. but they could share it with people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so fun. It was so fun.
And the women worked in English.
They did. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of them had wanted to be reporters. A lot of them, if given the opportunity, would study journalism. Mm-hmm. But because it is incredibly dangerous for any journalists in Cambodia, and we're not just talking about, like, you're never going to get a job and you're
right.
never, it's like you're going to get shot or killed. And because it's particularly dangerous for young women who have a long, long history of not being recognized as sort of, you know, full and complete individuals, they didn't have the opportunity. And so they saw it as a way of doing that anyway. But because, in fact, zine making and journalism have quite a bit in common, we used English so that we would have that extra barrier of protection. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of English speaking. There's radio programs and two different print newspapers in Cambodia that sort of get away with more because they're in English mm-hmm. and there's this sense that they're not going to be widely read or understood.
Mm-hmm. And the sorts of stories that and narratives that were shared, I think I remember reading one that was the history of Phnom Penh.
Yeah.
As retold and illustrated, as I recall.
Yeah.
What other sort of stories were shared?
Well, one of the most charming pieces that was also in that show was by a woman named Panya, who just sat down. You walked in and you said, okay, we're going to do this crazy thing and fold the paper and draw the thing. And she just sort of sat down, sequestered herself in a corner and started working right away. And when she looked up, you know, and handed me her thing, she had drawn this amazing little explanation of how to celebrate the Khmer New Year. and all these adorable drawings of monks who you sort of give alms to, and then they pray and they make these noises, and then there are these certain games that you play, all of which she illustrated. And when she handed it back to me, she said, "It's nice to be a cartoonist." Which I was there. I was studying cartooning. She's the third female cartoonist in the history of Cambodia. And I was so like, where are you getting this? You know, like, it's not, I was so impressed by her. They also talked about issues of agriculture, of course. Rice farming was a really great zine theme. I mean, who knew? Wouldn't that be great if we had like zines about rice production here? I would read them. Anyway.
Time to talk to 4-H Club.
Time to talk to 4-H. I know. Those kids will be great. Rice. Not too many overt politics. We had one great woman who, her first zine was the kinds of things that I like to draw. And so each page had a picture of something that she liked to draw. But after she finished it, it took kind of a long time, and she wanted to create a second edition, but she didn't want to actually spend that much time on it. So her second edition was called The Kinds of Things I Think It Is Easy to Draw, which is a much faster read.
I think I like that one.
Yeah,
it's the Slacker Nation
uniting
in Cambodia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have their definitely disinterest in doing work. But they also, I mean, the other thing that I have to explain about these women is that they were chosen to live in this dormitory because it is incredibly uncommon for young people in Cambodia to have any sense of social justice. And they are among the very first large group of women to be educated in Cambodia, because in the mid-1990s, when the colleges were rebuilt, what happened was that they didn't build any dormitories that were actually connected to the university. And so the school officials, of course, after the Khmer Rouge, and by the way, the Khmer Rouge, of course, had killed off anyone who might actually be able to properly physically build, manage, or work at a university. And so there was just sort of no base of knowledge to start from. So it was this very haphazard thing of building the school, and they'll figure out housing later. And what happened was that early in 2003, a friend of mine went to Cambodia and basically was sort of wandering the schools and said, "Oh, this is great, but I want to see a classroom that has, you know, young women students. Like, let's see a co-ed classroom." The person who was giving them the tour said, "This is a co-ed classroom. Women are totally welcome to attend school. They just can't rent apartments or live in monasteries." Mm-hmm. And so there's no options for them to live while they attend school. Mm-hmm. So this dormitory was built as a way of giving them a place to live so that they could actually go to school. And they were chosen by this great sense that each of them had to actually build a community together and become women leaders in this still emerging nation.
Wow. So it really, I mean, it's sort of a radical change right then and there, by them being able to go to school, to study, to have this dormitory, because that had been a real barrier to their being in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think such sort of artificial barriers have been used throughout time to portray freedom and portray access. If only you could do this, pay the poll tax, or some other artificial barrier, and then sort of interesting to then be able to work with them on zines and to on the publishing. Now, one thing, a project that came out of this was something called New Girl Law,
right? Yeah, and a part of the reason why sort of women weren't considered when considering the general population of Cambodia, sort of, you know, women were sort of not considered in a number of different areas, and still today there's this is a situation. One of the reasons is this book that was written. There are a couple of different versions of it, but one of them was written in around 1863 by a I believe his name is King Ongdul, who wrote basically a book of Proverbs. This is the best, you know, what little publishing there is in Cambodia mm-hmm. is usually along the lines of Proverbs. And they're sort of great, amazing reads. But this particular one was the Chibap Sarai, the Rules for Girls. There's also Chibap Ros, or Rules for Boys, mm-hmm. Which is much shorter. And the Rules for Girls, I mean, there are some very interesting and reasonable rules about respecting elders and, you know, caring for other people and building community. But there are also rules that we would consider sort of appalling in Western society. And one of them is that, you know, you should submit to your husband if he chooses to beat you, because that is your role. Mm. And you should not look boys in the eye. All of these things tend to sort of keep women out of the public sphere, and in a lot of ways, you know, have caused this situation now where there's only, you know, 36 young women that are able to go to college and feel sort of empowered to be members mm-hmm. of their society in any way. I shouldn't say only 36, but definitely this is the largest group of them.
Mm-hmm. And so you worked on New Girl Law.
Yeah. I didn't know that the self-publishing project would work. And the way that I knew that it would work was not just that I saw the girls getting engaged in it over the entire time that I was there was about 2 months. And over the first 6 weeks of that 2 months period, it went from being something that the girls were engaged in and excited about, and then engaged in and excited about when I was there, to engaged in and excited about when I wasn't there, making zines that they traded with each mm-hmm. other that I like never got the chance to read, which is still upsetting to me, to them bringing these out to their own communities and sharing them with neighbors and parents and friends. And actually then, of course, a part of zine making, the probably most important part of zine making, is creating a distribution network, is building a readership, is creating the audience mm-hmm. for whom you're making these things. And we actually had a number of drop points throughout the city that we would go and visit, and we would distribute these zines. And one of the things that I started noticing was that we would bring these zines in, the issue of commercialism that I'd noted in Cambodia made me sort of adherent to this idea that we would create them for free. Then I got a grant to actually pay for them. Mm-hmm. And so we would create these zines. We would bring them to bookstores and cafes and some of these other art spaces and leave them there for people to pick up. And the first, you know, explanation was like this weird thing. The shopkeeper was like, why would you do this? Who wants to read this? And then, you know, a couple days later, we get an email. They are gone. Please return with some more zine. And so we would bring back more. And really quickly, we would be going through 500 of these a day. I mean, it was phenomenally successful. Mm. And the girls began to get really excited about that.
Right.
And so my understanding is that they just got jazzed on the idea. They began to see the power that they mm-hmm. could have in making their own media. And they, one of them came to me with this idea that we can maybe consider rewriting the Chibap Sarai. I mean, the last thing on earth that you want to do is emulate colonialism. Mm-hmm. And especially, I think, as a feminist, I am deeply concerned about exporting any of what I believe to be feminist to anywhere else, right? I can sort of react as my own person with my own experiences. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I was invited to be there, was to sort of be someone that they could watch having these reactions about the issues of women in Cambodia. But I was sort of like, wow, that's a really big, like the Chibap Sarai is a mm-hmm. really big, important document. But we started having these discussions. And eventually we came up with an actual 20-point plan for not necessarily just improving the lives of women in Cambodia, but actually it became a very humanist document. It became mm-hmm. very much about actually very much about human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And my agreement with them was that we would write this together. We would discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
I did audio tape those discussions, and I've made them into an audio book. And then I would go back and I would actually make a document for them. I would make this into a book, mm-hmm. which I was lucky enough to be invited to live in Providence, Rhode Island for a little while and letterpress and hand bind 50 copies of this.
Yes. And I have a copy
have
here that you brought along
right
here.
There. I can see it.
And it ranges from number 7, women should be brave, smart, and confident and should build and strengthen their abilities, to 13, more humanist in its outlook. Not that 7 is not humanist in its outlook. I don't mean to set them up as oppositional. Women and men should be given free health care and preventative health education.
Yeah, there was a really amazing moment in the middle of this discussion, because the discussion, of course, came out of, like, as girls, what do we need to get up to speed with the rest of our culture? Like, now that you're feeling empowered enough to make your own media, but you still have very deep connections to these women all around you all of the time who have none of that sense of entitlement, what can we do to get everyone up to your speed, first of all, but then make you all feel comfortable at an even higher level? And so we started having that discussion. And at one point, literally one of the girls turned to me and said, wait, how can we possibly be demanding women's rights when we don't actually have human rights?
Hmm.
And it was this gut-wrenching thing of like, I wish that weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish that I even had an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden it went from being sort of a pro-girl document to this document of like, hey, we still need, you know, to survive in this culture, which mm-hmm. is where, of course, it gets really tricky to actually be considering having these books in Cambodia mm-hmm. at all, because that's what that comes down to, is pointing out intense government corruption and mm-hmm. being vocal about things that government is doing to sort of keep people in poverty.
Hmm. So these books and have been on display here, and obviously copies have been distributed here. Have any gone back to Cambodia?
Well, I needed to get a couple copies to the girls.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent 4 copies under like secret cover with a special messenger, and they did receive them, and the special messenger did manage to actually audio tape that, and there's this great audio of the girl who's given the package says, you know, oh, it's from Anne in America. It must be candy. And she starts opening it really quickly. And then, you know, there's this kind of obvious disappointment that it's not actually candy. And then there's this realization that it's the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they just all start like giggling and laughing and reading it. And and that was kind of the entire moment that project had mm-hmm. been about.
And I'd like to continue this conversation if you're welcome, if you're willing to come back.
Absolutely. I would love to.
And you have an online presence.
I do. I have a small blog called Democracy Guest List. Google me. It's really easy to find what I'm doing.
AnnElizabethMoore.com. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. If you have comments about the program, please send them to me, Paul@MediaGeek.net. And of course, check out the Twitter feed. Sometimes there's questions. You can tweet back your answers or send your own questions. Twitter.com/MediaGeek. Thanks for tuning in.